So, after 47 days of the Anglo trial, the final verdicts come in yesterday. Dervil MacDonald, legal affairs editor of the Irish Independent, is with me in studio. Thanks for coming in, Dervil. So, after such a long trial, just take us back less than 24 hours to the atmosphere in court as it neared the conclusion yesterday.
Yeah, it was a very, very tense atmosphere in court yesterday. There were three men originally on trial. That was Sean Fitzpatrick, Pat Whelan and William McAteer. And the acquittal by the jury of Sean Fitzpatrick on counts in relation to the Maple 10 loans. There were two sets of loans at the heart of this July 2008 lending scheme. One was a 160 million euro set of loans to members of the Quinn family. The second was the 450 million euro to the Maple 10 loans. Sean Fitzpatrick, you might recall, had been acquitted by direction of the trial judge in relation to the Quinn loans due to lack of evidence. And then the jury came back and acquitted him in respect of the Maple 10 loans, and he bounded out of court outside the Criminal Courts of Justice, his smile appearing before him, overjoyed at that. But his two co-accused, Pat Whelan and William McAteer, who stood accused still in relation to all 16 counts, had a difficult night overnight waiting to see what their fate would be. And the jury came back yesterday. They'd been offered the option of majority verdicts after over 11 and a half hours of the deliberations, which means that they can bring in counts on which at least 10 of them are agreed. But they came back yesterday with unanimous counts, finding them not guilty in respect of the Quinn loans, but guilty in respect of the Maple 10 loans. And the first count, it was extraordinary, the first count that was read out was a not guilty one. And everyone just presumed, oh, this is going to be like Sean Fitzpatrick. This is going to be a successive mantra of not guilty, not guilty. Then it was the second count and it was guilty, and it was just kind of, it was that scenario for the state, you know, and actually for the Quinn family and their civil proceedings. Would the jury come back and decide that one set of loans were lawful and the others weren't? And that is in fact what happened in the case. And although juries give verdicts and not reasons, I think it's reasonable to infer that they regarded the loans to the Quinn family in some sense as commercial loans falling within the ordinary course of business requirement of Section 60, but found that the loans to the Maple 10, where the recourse was 25%, couldn't be construed in the ordinary course of business. So in terms of what are the big questions following the Anglo trial, the first obviously is for the two accused, the two people who've now convicted, Pat Whelan and William McAteer.
And you're writing today that there may be a different kind of sentence hearing. It's going to be, I think it's on Monday week on the 28th, and Mr. Judge Justice Nolan is going to take into account things that were the source of a lot of back and forth in the absence of the jury during the trial.
Yeah, unknown to the jury and to the members of the public, there were actually significant breaks in the Anglo trial. There was over a week of legal argument in respect of the admission of legal advice that had been obtained by Anglo, and that was a huge debate that we might maybe separately speak about. And it raised its head in various different guises throughout the trial, and the jury, as is normal in many criminal trials, kind of traipsed in and out. But they were off for the best part of a week at one point. But Judge Nolan, in his charge to the jury in relation to the law, he said, look, this might seem quite harsh to you, but I am instructing you as a matter of law, you cannot take into account legal advice, any mention of legal advice, he said, that may have been obtained by the bank. He said, you cannot. And, you know, it was extraordinary, the evidence of the former financial regulator, Patrick Neary, and his number second in command, Con Horan. And the jury heard all of that. They saw all of that. They were entitled to take their views on the credibility or otherwise of the regulator's state of knowledge about the various schemes. And what he said was, you can't take that into account. You can't take into account the role of Morgan Stanley, the big blue chip Stellar Bank, that had an involvement in the execution of the deal. And he said that might seem quite harsh to you. But on the flip side of that, what he did indicate in the absence of the jury was that we might have a kind of a special hearing, a special sentence hearing, known as a Newton hearing. And this is where we think and we expect that those issues that he excluded from the jury, the legal advice, the regulator, all of those issues may be taken into account as significant mitigating factors.
On that point, before we go any further, it was something that was alluded to by my colleague Orla O'Donnell, our legal affairs correspondent, on Primetime last night. It was then, this point was picked up afterwards then by Finbar McCauley, the Professor Emeritus of Law at UCD, this on the decision not to put the issue of legal advice that may have been offered to Anglo before the jury.
The point that Orla's made there about the judge's ruling in the course of which he effectively excluded that evidence. I think that, with all due respects to the judge, I mean, they have to make these line calls in very difficult situations. But I would have thought that that's a mistake. It seemed the prosecution argument seemed to be that this was effectively mistake of law. In fact, they used the famous Latin maxim, ignorantia juris, was bandied about, meaning mistake of law is never a defense. But I think when you scrutinize what the defense were saying, they weren't actually alleging that they didn't know that Section 60 existed or that they didn't know what the subsections said. Their argument was that on the advice they had received from their own lawyers, that they thought the behavior they were purporting to do came within the relevant provisions. That's not mistake of law, with all due respects to the learned counsel. That's mistake of fact.
Now, there could be a lot of argument, and clearly there was, Dervla, and you were there for, I think, all of it in the court on this very point. Now, are we looking at what might be, if there is to be an appeal, the grounds for an appeal?
We are, and the one of the... you know, I've been covering courts for 10 years, and one of the really fantastic things about the Anglo trial was seeing the level of advocacy. The jury didn't get to see it, the public didn't get to see it, on this issue of the issue of liability. And essentially, what the defence were saying is, look, we don't even want the contents of the legal advice to go in, because in one sense it doesn't matter if the legal advice was good, bad, indifferent, mistaken or brilliant. But what we want to show is that the fact that legal advice was taken proves that we don't have a guilty mind. We didn't go in and, you know, knowingly, we didn't have the mens rea or the mental intent to commit this crime. And they wanted to show, look, this is a reasonable step. And Section 60 is a section which bans the provision of financial assistance unless it can be proved in the ordinary course of business. But there's a relationship between another catch-all provision that covers all 400 offences in the Companies Act, which says that as an officer, you're presumed to have been in default of the Companies Act unless you took certain reasonable steps to prevent the breach. And they were saying, well, look, if we can't show that we took a reasonable step, that legal advice wasn't a reasonable step, in effect, they were saying, you're implicitly making this an absolute liability offence. Now, here's the science bit, and I hope I don't lose you. There are three types of liability in Irish law: absolute liability, strict liability and ordinary liability. And the absolute liability might be a drink driving, you know, offence. You don't have any defence. And we saw this issue quite painfully in the 2006 statutory rape crisis, where someone who had been accused and convicted of having sex with a minor had said, look, I was mistaken. I didn't know what age she was. And we had that prospect of 40 convicted paedophiles seeking their release. But
on the mistake of fact.
On the mistake of fact. Now, what the state in this case argued was, look, no, that mistake as to fact is one thing, but ignorance of the law is another. But there was a very, very fine, really, really extraordinary debate about, well, what defences should be open to you? Because they were saying, well, look, we haven't got the offer of good faith, reasonable care, due diligence open to us. You know, we can't rebut that presumption that we were in default by showing that we took a step and we believe this is a reasonable step. Now, one of the complicating factors about all of this, because any future appeals, in my own view, and it's not a legal one, will have very, very little to do with banking, very, very little to do with lending, and all to do with the distinctions between absolute and ordinary liability and strict liability in Irish law. And this was debated at a very high level, presumably in anticipation of an appeal. And what the judge was kind of saying in the absence of the jury is, look, I can't read a defence into law that doesn't exist. He took the view that it was a strict liability offence. And this was, you know, this kind of the reason why I sat through the legal argument is that if there are any appeals in the future, somebody might have to come forward and explain. But this was debated at a high level. One of the complicating factors is that those differences between absolute, strict and ordinary liability are not set down in legislation in Irish law. They are judge-made law.
And there was even an independent expert witness brought in to the court itself.
There was. Lyndon McCann was a senior counsel. He's best known as a commercial lawyer. And he provides sections advice on Section 60. He said at least on a monthly basis. He said it was something that arose constantly in his practice. And what he talked about, you know, he talked about financial institutions and in relation to complex financing of transactions. And he said where the issues arise, company directors might go to their solicitors, they might seek advice from counsel. And he said the people look for advice where company directors have a real concern that they're not in breach of legislation, you know, criminal as well as civil, and especially where there are consequences either in a civil or criminal context or where may have financial consequences, you know. And I think it was said that it was fair to say that people do seek advice to prevent a breach. And, you know, speaking to commercial and criminal lawyers, both during and the wake of the Anglo trial, they say that the ruling on legal advice has struck fear into the heart of company directors because people do seek comfort. You know, there's over 400 offences. Not everybody knows. And we have, in Ireland, a compliance-based system rather than an enforcement-based system in company law. And they're now kind of probably waking up going, saying, well, look, you know, we went to the lawyers, we got legal advice. You know, we're no experts on company law, but we did seek it. If we can't plead that, is it fair that...
I suppose, is it fair that we're then hung out to dry on the basis of having done what we thought was the right thing?
Yeah.
Do we know anything about the extent, the depth, the quality of the legal advice that they were relying on? Was it in writing? You know, how senior were the people? How qualified were they? Or was it on the basis of a quick phone call?
There's a significant backstory, I think, to the legal advice. What we did hear was that it cost around €3,000. What we did hear was that although a lot of people relied on it, that there was a significant factual difference in respect of the legal advice between Anglo's former head of compliance and the solicitor who provided it. I expect that in this Newton hearing or this special potential sentencing hearing that we get, those issues may be fleshed out more.
Anglo put an interpretation, but the solicitor who gave it, did that come in court saying that's not quite what I said or that's not what I said at all?
Well, we didn't hear from the solicitor who provided it. It was claimed provided the legal advice, but I think that there's going to be a factual dispute about the quality and content of that advice.
Now, somebody else who was there for all of this, Ruan McCormack, the legal correspondent of the Irish Times, writing today about Patrick Neary's contribution. He said, by this reporter's count, in 2 days in the box, Neary said, I don't recall 30 times. He said, I don't know 23 times. I can't recall 12 times. I can't stroke, don't, cannot remember 12 times. That's a complete blank to me once, and I've absolutely no recollection 4 times. So that's probably over 70 moments where he was in a position where it seems he wasn't helping to provide clarity on what may have been said to him or by him or information he would have had. So that is something which is going to come into consideration then in this sentencing hearing.
I think that the judge who, you know, certainly when he gave the legal advice ruling, you know, I think he felt in the debates around it, felt constrained about reading into the law of defence that he said didn't exist, you know, and that he couldn't do that. I think nonetheless he formed certain views on the evidence of the regulator and on the role and involvement of other parties. And I think that those factors following the legal submissions at the sentence hearing on April 28th will form part of his sentencing and may give rise to mitigating factors. And it's something that I think that if the sentence is not what the public expects, maybe these nuances are something that we might maybe reflect on closer to the time.
Right. And what about then a person who was referred to as, was it Hamlet without the Prince or
Banquo's Ghost?
Banquo's Ghost, sorry. that's David Drum, the former chief executive of Anglo. Again, suggestions that, you know, he was at the heart of this. Clearly he was. And that came out in evidence. But there seems to be an expectation building now that there are grounds for having or seeking to have him extradited from the United States, where he's been living for several years, to face charges in relation to these events.
Yeah, the jury were constantly told that they weren't to cast their mind to those who were not there or maybe speculating why certain people were or were not prosecuted. But it was impossible to ignore David Drum because he appeared in every single days of evidence. The judge in his charge to the jury described David Drum at the author, and I think it's a fair and a reasonable question to ask, why was he not before the courts? He's due to have a bankruptcy hearing in May in the US, but one of the questions, why hasn't he been extradited? And I think there are potentially two answers to that. The first, as we saw in the Ian Bailey case, you can't just extradite someone for the sake of questioning alone. But I think the second, and this goes, you know, the Section 60 of the company the Companies Act, you know, it was a unique prosecution in part because it had never been tried in a criminal law context before. But one of the requirements for extradition, and this applies to Ireland and America, is that there needs to be an equivalence of the offence to justify extraditing someone. And I think that Section 60 was just so technical. And I think that that's one of the reasons why they're having a difficulty perhaps extraditing him on that basis. But I think, you know, that the ordinary punter might feel that it was a little bit unfair that, you know, certain persons were before the court when the man described as the author was not. And I think that perhaps the state parties have questions to ask over that.
Aside from Section 60, which you say doesn't have an equivalent piece of law in the United States, is there some other provision that might be used that would tick the box in America?
Yeah, look, I mean, one of the things, and again, these are one of the questions that, you know, you kind of can ask after the fact, is that at the very end of the case, in the summing up, the prosecution dropped what Patrick Gageby, who was representing William McAteer, described as a bombshell, where they suggested that a March 2008 agreement, this was a couple of months before the July one, which didn't go ahead because they couldn't find investors, was probably unlawful. You know, he said it may well have been approved by the regulator, may have been fraudulent, may have been unlawful. And this was described by Mr. Gageby as a bombshell. But another feature of the prosecution's summing up, which they didn't lead in terms of charges or evidence, was that the suggestion that this might be some sort of market abuse or market manipulation. And I'm sure there are equivalent provisions in US law. When we look to the you know, the next big question, what happens in respect of the €2.34 billion case that the Quinn family have waged against the state, part of their claim in the civil courts, where there's a lower standard, a lower burden of proof, relates to Section 60. But the main thrust of it relates to claims that the loans given to them were market manipulation or market abuse. And I thought that was very interesting because, as I understand it, the DPP did consider charges of market abuse but didn't lead them in this trial. And people might have questions, maybe wondering why they selected the charges that they did.
And of course, behind all of this was the building up of Sean Quinn and his family stake in Anglo. Now, they have other litigation against the state. They have been taking a very close interest in the proceedings and in the outcome yesterday. Where does this leave them?
Well, a member of the Quinn family attended every single day of the Anglo trial, almost maintaining a watching brief, you know, whether it was Sean Quinn's son-in-law, who's a solicitor, Niall, or another member of the family. And clearly they had an interest in the evidence being led in the criminal proceedings to see what benefit they could have for their civil case. Bit of a setback, I think, you know, really for them, in so far as the jury decided that the loans in this case to them were lawful, because it suggests that there was a legitimate commercial basis to them. The state had been quite desperate, certainly towards the end of this trial, to make sure that the Quinn loans were captured by illegality. But it will be very, very hard to predict. Look, I mean, if you think the Anglo trial was long, we're looking at least 9 months of litigation in the civil courts between Quinn and all of those other cases. But I suppose one of the questions I asked myself this morning and expressed in the pages of the Irish Independent was, you know, let's go back and look at this. Here was Sean Quinn, you know, and I've no doubt, absolutely no doubt, that his motivations were sincere to build up wealth and enduring wealth for his children and his grandchildren. But he built up a secret stake in Anglo Irish Bank. A secret stake. The media and market rumours, he didn't go and buy the shares openly on the market. He didn't declare his hand, so to speak. And the first time this was formally confirmed, despite market rumours, was at the Ardboyne Hotel in Navan on September 11th, I think, 2007, where he said, I've got 24% stake in the bank.
And he told this to Shawnee Fitz and Drum.
Shawnee Fitz and David Drum. And interestingly, David Drum was instructed by the board to go immediately to Pat Neary, who doesn't appear to recall the meeting the next day and doesn't appear to recall David Drum telling him anything about the 24% stake. I think he said he was surprised to get a call from David Drum. He thought it might have been for a personal matter. Michael Higgins, senior counsel for Sean Fitzpatrick, said, what do you mean? You know, was it kind of like troubles at home or inquiring about where to go on holidays? And Pat Neary said, well, yes, it could have contemplated that, you know. And it was kind of one of those moments of the trial where you kind of wanted to throw rocks. But in any event, this was disclosed, and what was Sean Quinn's problem, there was a fatal attraction really between himself and the bank, because monies, various monies, were sent to the Quinn group were they working capital? Were they to fund this, the CFD position? But in any event, over almost 2 billion was lent to the Quinn Group. And that, you know, you've some sympathy, I have to say, for the directors of Anglo. And indeed the state, when it later had to try and come and deal with this issue, because nobody invited Sean Quinn to build up that big bet. And now we have a scenario where he is going into court armed with these verdicts and ostensibly could win.
Yes, but you think the fact that he wasn't open himself might tell against him in due course?
Yeah, there's kind of a principle, you know, that if you're coming seeking equity or a remedy in the courts, you have to come with clean hands. And I think that, you know, when these matters come before the courts, because sometimes, you know, we're being promised a banking inquiry, sometimes the legal arena, whether it's civil or criminal courts, can decide things on a very narrow and technical basis. But, you know, the other thing that, the state has been engaged. Now, we don't hear much because the IBRC has gone into a super-duper bunk since its liquidation, but I'd love to ask Kieran Wallace, a special liquidator, and his minister, Michael Noonan, where are you on the Quinn monies? These monies, these properties, where the rental income that went around the world, significant amounts of money were spent on that. You know, that was another major part of this case, missing millions.
Lots.
And so much.
And lots still and so much to be untangled, Derval. Thank you indeed for shedding that light. You've been writing really well about this, as have many others. It's another one of those days when the advice has to be go out and buy a paper, whatever the paper is, and read it and just absorb and learn. And I want to just take one small quote from somebody else who's been writing brilliantly, Miriam Lord in the Irish Times today, saying, "Forget the racing and the old school rugby, the helicopter jaunts to Formula One, the overseas soccer skites and those croaker pilgrimages to cheer on the county. Above all, there is one sport which the people with money, influence and power in this country absolutely revere. They don't just follow it, they play it. And the game? Pass the parcel, around and round. The eminent players advise each other on what decisions to make, dodging personal responsibility at every successful handoff, feeding and gaining strength from each other in what becomes an unbreakable sequence of memory loss and corporate cahoots." Lots more from Miriam Lord on page 3 of the Irish Times. Derval, thank you for coming to studio. We leave it there. Back with Mary Louise at a Passion Play after the break.